Yeah, so lots of kitsch. And then that's actually dedicated to just Firefly.
Oh, I didn't even see that.
You've watched Firefly, right?
Yeah, I love Firefly.
So I've been subscribing to the Loot Crate Firefly thing for, I don't know, a year or 2 years, what something crate? Like that. Loot Crate. It's they kind of invented the subscription crate thing, but for specifically for geeks.
Mm-hmm.
So every month, or every 2 months, you get one of the crew members.
Wow.
So I'm getting Inara later this month.
Wow.
So I'm only one away from completing my set.
Wow.
And I ended up with Saffron, and I'm skipping Badger. So I'm like, I only want the crew, damn it. But
which one? Oh, who was Badger?
He was the guy with the bowler hat.
Yeah.
He was also on Battlestar Galactica. He pops up a lot of places, that actor. But yeah, he was like the very, you know, established criminal, but he's really like a thug. So
cool.
Yeah. Kitsch everywhere.
Nice.
Hi, we are Buddies in Space. You are?
S. Michael Smith. You are?
M. Michael Crossi. You are?
I'm Jefferson Savangsuk.
That's how you say it.
That's how you say it.
It was one of those awkward things where I was like, I have no idea how to say it, so we'll just get him to say it.
It's really long. It looks complicated, but it, you know, it basically sounds how it reads.
Just long.
Yeah, just long.
All right, so what nationality is that name? Where does that come
It's from? Laotian.
Laotian, okay.
Yeah. And I forget what it means. I can't speak Lao, unfortunately, because my parents decided not to teach me and my brother to speak Lao so that we would be like all American kids and speak English well.
No, I've heard of that. I mean, that's like that's a real thing that happens a lot.
Were they the first generation?
Yeah,
here?
So they're first.
You're
first
second generation.
We're second generation, and of course, there's all the. You know, the controversy about, like, what's the definition of first generation, what's second generation, but how I think of it is my parents being the first to become American in the family. We're first generation. I'm second generation. And so, right, there's the belief that, you know, your kids to be all American, don't teach them the, you know, the foreign language, and they speak English really well, which I think I speak English all right.
I can't understand a word you're saying.
Can you slow down and speak American?
And louder? Can you understand me?
Are your children... So there's a thing, I have a sociology background. Do your children have a real interest in your background?
Some.
Wait, how old are your kids?
My eldest, this month, will be turning 30.
Hmm.
And then, my daughter. And then our second daughter is 19. She just started freshman year at college,
nice.
Bryn Mawr. And our son is 16.
That's a little shocking to me because you look so young.
Yeah.
You really do.
Would not have pegged you as having a 30-year-old child.
You get started early enough, it could happen.
I guess, yeah. I don't really know about that. Mike will never know about that. If he has his way. Has your 30-year-old shown interest in your background?
Where they've shown the interest, I guess, is where we've exposed them to Lao culture. We've traveled to Laos.
Oh, nice.
But it's not been the type of interest where the sort of like they've sort of spontaneously of their own initiative, like, oh, you know, I want to get all into this. It hasn't been quite like that.
Okay. There is something called third generation return.
Oh.
Because what you're describing is extremely typical. First generation to arrive in America wants their children to be all American, and then their children will often, so the third generation will often be like, wait, I have like a fairly strong cultural like background that I've been divorced from. I want to know more about that. Mm-hmm. Doesn't always happen, but it is a legitimate thing.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it could happen. You know, they're you know the younger kids. I mean, they're still on the young side. It seems like at least the stories that I've heard of, at least from like Native American folks that I know, like, you know, they've had, you know, their childhood, and then sort of like as an adult, they've, you know, re-explored their ancestry.
Absolutely.
I know what I want to say. Getting back to the language. So it's been studied, this phenomenon, and they've compared kids, you know, like me versus the kids that were taught, you know, to be bilingual since a young age. And it is true that as young children learning the language, they are behind the other kids in terms of their language skills.
Right.
But then as they grow, sort of like bigger kids, then they catch up and they know two languages.
Right.
And,
okay.
And I'm stuck with just the one.
Well, there is a very interesting statistic that you don't hear bandied about very often, but there is a mild but statistically significant increase in the, and I learned this in school, in the tendency towards sociopathic behavior in bilingual children.
Oh,
it's extremely small. It's extremely small.
Okay.
But there is a statistically significant increase in the likelihood therein. So
my parents saved me.
Your parents
they
kept
saved
you
me.
From becoming Dexter.
That's
they
right.
didn't save you. They saved
they
other
saved
people.
That,
oh,
they
right.
saved the two other
That's
dudes
true.
In the basement with
That's
you right,
right.
now.
That's
yeah.
right.
So, Smike, we'll get to the list. Don't worry. I do want to say we are joined by what I think... arguably is a fair title, the most interesting man in the world.
Oh, gosh.
and to share, because your wife totally set this up, which was so funny. So we sat down with you and I said, hey, I know Smike talked to you. We'd really like to get you on the podcast. You have, you know, so many interesting things that you do and interests. And your wife, like, without missing me, I don't know if she was humble bragging or she was legitimately asking me, but she's like, oh, are you going to talk about, like, beekeeping? Or are you going to talk about how he just won a Native American Music Award? Or, and I'm like, and she just goes rattling the stuff off, and I'm just like, as a podcaster, I'm like, yes, just give me all of these things.
So you, nice. you come across as a fairly humble not reserved, but you know, you don't like, you're not out there.
We saw your Mustang. Let's not throw reserved around too much.
Okay. That's all going out the window. This is going to be all about you and how amazingly awesome you are.
I have surgical implements everywhere. We're going to cut the skin from your skull, saw that puppy open, and just dive right in.
Okay. Well, I do want to prepare you guys, I mean, for this, but like, I am serious, but I am an introvert. I am an introvert, so
it's cool. I am too.
Okay.
I am also an introvert, and it's something that I kind of I do this. I kind of turn it off, and I can do this for like a little while.
Okay.
But you know, after I'm done
That's
with
the
podcast
the
or a stage show,
excellent.
Yeah, then I'm like, okay, I got to go back in my shelf.
Did you try the drink?
Oh no, not yet.
Give it a try. I'm really happy with it.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Oh.
I'm liking it. It's not, you know, it's not a super sweet drink.
No.
It's got a nice kind of herbal something going on.
It actually ended up with all the weird things I mixed, ended up back pretty close to what I was going for, which was a riff on a white Cuba Libre. Mm. So traditionally, Cuba Libres are dark rum, Coke, and lime.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't feeling dark rum because I've had so much of it in recent memories. So I wanted, you know, just a white Cuba Libre, but I wanted a different soda. Smike had recently asked about that Fentimin soda.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just white rum, cola, and lime, this is white rum, a little bit of apple pie moonshine from Black Button Distillery. Because I thought it'd be interesting, a little extra there. I don't know if you really get it in there. But and then instead of cola, we are drinking Fentimin's Dandelion and Burdock. Herbal tincture.
Yes. Botanically brewed.
Yes. It is fermented. So it's cola-ish, but really not. It's much more mild. And then, of course, lime juice.
Yeah.
So I like that.
I would almost put in a little mint, maybe.
You know what? I thought about throwing basil in.
Yeah.
I think mint would be fine. I think, basically, once you get into the Fentimans world, you can just start throwing herbs in like crazy, and like just turn into an Italian sauce, and it's probably going to work. Because
it's
complex.
So while we're talking about alcohol, let's take this back to the beginning of when we met you.
Yeah,
and that was
because you're actually a very specific relation to both of us.
Yeah, so we met you at one of our sake meetups.
Yes.
It was like a month, 3 or 4 years ago.
Something like that.
A while ago. Yeah. And you had had an interest in sake, obviously, at that point, and. Since that first meetup, you have actually started brewing your own sake.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and since then.
Yes.
Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, which part of it?
The brewing part. Okay. You know,
do you chew the rice before you put the koji in?
That would probably add some very interesting flavors. So, yeah, so I guess to kind of... To go back, like way back to where, like, where did this interest come from? This kind of ties into
the brewing.
If you could turn back time.
So, you guys, I'm sure, have heard of like the Maker movement. There's the Maker movement. Ever heard of this?
Maybe not under that name. Are you just talking about the concept of bringing back old like techniques of doing things?
Basically, that's the idea. Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. So there's this magazine, Make Magazine, and there's like these maker fairs, like in big cities. Mm. There's the Rochester Mini Maker Fair that I think is going to be like the third one. I think third or fourth one this November.
So it's coming up soon.
It's coming right up. Yeah, you got to go to it. It's mm-hmm. it's really awesome.
All right. So tell us a little bit about what are these maker fairs? What kind of stuff goes on there?
Basically, it's people who are interested in like building stuff, making stuff, crafts. I mean, electronics, traditional crafts, like weaving. You know, like I mean, anything you could think of where you actually like build stuff yourself,
roll up craft sleeves stuff, and do it.
But especially booze.
Actually, Black Button Brewery was at the last one giving samples. And
nice.
Yeah, I tried that.
I loved everything.
That moonshine apple.
It's pretty good
stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, it gets back to this, like, you know, as opposed to big manufacturers making stuff that you buy from, like you build it yourself. 3D 3D printing.
Yeah.
That's a huge community of that. So were you into something else in the maker movement?
So, well, I subscribe to the magazine. That's kind of like how I work. I'm kind of like a dreamer. And so like I you know, all these ideas sort of, you know, float through my mind. I pop up and like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then over kind of like years, that idea kind of like grows into something eventually.
That's cool.
So Make Magazine, there was this article, how to brew your own sake. And I hadn't even thought about sake. And, I was reading the article and it's kind of interesting. I may have had sake a few times at the Japanese restaurants, mm-hmm. That was not particularly interesting to me, but like, okay, but the concept of, oh, like brewing the sake was intriguing to me. And in medical school, I brewed a lot of beer.
That seems to go, it makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons.
It does.
But then I got busy after graduating from medical school, and I kind of like dropped it. So the sake idea, was intriguing to me. And then I started to have these other ideas like, hey, there's this amazing, farm winery industry in the Finger Lakes. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe someone ought to have like a farm sake brewery. And so I started mm-hmm. to explore that idea, and it didn't get very far because the ABC, I forget what it stands for, basically the state kind of liquor regulation agency told me that the brewery would, even though sake is brewed, it's rice, it's grain, mm-hmm. it's not grapes, but because of the alcohol content, it would fall under the
wine, the
farm winery stuff, regulation. And by those regulations, like pretty much like almost 100% of the inputs have to be New York grown.
Sort of difficult to pull that off with sake.
Right. Yeah. So it's hard to source the rice at this point.
Right. And so I researched that and like there is no like rice commercially grown.
Where are their rice paddies in New York State?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of like a dream for, you know, another future, I guess.
Another state.
Who knows? I mean, it could be possible in New York.
That does seem awfully silly that there's... Yeah, you can make it, but you have to have locally sourced rice.
Rice.
Right.
There is no locally... Well, okay.
Well, I guess you're SOL, my friend.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just wait, you know, a few years and climate change will catch up and...
Yeah.
Right. Well, we are going to be a tropical paradise.
Yeah.
The beachfront property, you know, is going to be amazing.
I love making that joke. That joke never gets old to me.
Yeah, it's true. It's going to happen.
Rochester's landlocked, if you don't know that. Anyway, go on.
We've got the lake.
Well, okay, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I like to think there's a massive amount of people listening who know nothing about where we live, But it's funny because it's not a massive amount of people listening.
Yeah, I would. Right. Yeah,
it's like we have a listenership of dozen.
And they're probably going to multiply that by 100 just having you here.
Yeah. I'm hoping you're sticky. I'm hoping we get like two or three to kind of stick around. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, so anyway, at least the part of the part of this dream, this idea that I could make happen was learning to brew the sake. Sure. So, I did that. I researched it, learned about it, read about it online, got books, ordered the ingredients. Started brewing some sake with a lot of help from my family, from my wife Lisa in particular, which often is the case with a lot of my projects. And she gives me, well, to my face, often she gives, and to friends and you know, whoever she talks to, she gives the impression that she's pretty disgusted with me and all of this stuff. But I am so grateful for all of her help with all these projects, because I wouldn't be able to do it by myself.
Nice. Yeah. I think you're supposed to insert the term long-suffering before you say why.
That's right.
So when you started coming to the sake meetups, you were already had long been brewing sake?
I don't think I had started yet.
Oh, okay.
It was still at that point an idea.
So was that the meetup like a little bit of a
yeah, well, nudge? Right. Yeah, right.
Did Smike pat you on the behind, would you say?
Well, I don't remember. This is probably the sake.
It's good. It's good you don't remember.
The sake
that.
Okay, sort of erased that part, sake meetup. Meetup.com is just such an amazing resource for letting you know what's going on in your community in terms of activities. And I founded and am facilitator of the Finger Lakes Flute Circle, which is a group of Native American flute enthusiasts get together and we play the Native American flute, and that's how I got introduced to Meetup. And then through Meetup, I found the sake.
And we're going to get to the flute in just
a little bit. We got to talk about
the flute. We've got so many things here.
So yeah, it was awesome because like it went from, you know, a little bit of interest in, or actually more conceptual interest in sake, to then like, learning from you and experiencing all of these different amazing sakes, like,
most of them were not even warm, which tends to shock a lot of people.
That's right.
Well, that's what I find most interesting about sake is that it's always, you know, it's rice water and koji, and just with those ingredients, you can have so many different kinds of flavor profiles.
And sometimes deep ocean different. Well water, Smike. kaiju sake.
But yeah, it's interesting how much variety you can get with just such seemingly limited ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I'm so appreciative of the sake meetup.
So how many how many batches have you made? Are you like on a certain generation now?
Well, let me think. I think it's four or five, but like half of those like didn't turn out well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're learning more and more each time.
Yeah.
So what's been the most challenging part of this process?
I think the most challenging part of it for me is all of the attention it requires, like the time that's required of it, because like my schedule is pretty crazy and it's very easy for me to like neglect stuff. And sometimes that's why some of the batches failed, is that the stuff is just, you know, fermenting and sort of minding its own business. And like, I have other things to do. And before I know it, like, you know, a whole bunch of time has passed.
You're the kind of guy who would kill a Tamagotchi.
So do you ever like, are you texting Lisa, can you please stir the rice?
Stir the rice. Wave your arms around the mold room.
That's a good idea. I don't think you'd do it, though.
There again, insert long-suffering.
There are limits, right. There are limits to what she'll do.
So what do you do?
For?
Like, an actual job.
My actual job.
International man of mystery.
My actual job is I'm an emergency physician at UR Medicine, Strong Memorial Hospital. Okay. It's my main thing. And then even with that, kind of like I have a kind of like a separate or side thing. So
of course you do.
So that's like three quarters of my time is emergency medicine. And
now most people would say
that's enough.
Working in the emergency room is like that's enough of a job for me.
Yeah,
I've got enough here.
I'm exhausted listening to you talk about it. Not even describing it, just listening to you talk about it. But go on. So what's the other quarter?
Yeah. So the other quarter. I mean, as you can imagine, there's tons of so interesting things in medicine. Mm-hmm. And one of
I can't imagine.
Human body is boring as heck.
And one of the fabulous things about emergency medicine as a career is that it's very flexible. So it allows you to pursue other things. And so I developed an interest in hospice and palliative medicine. And so about a quarter of my time, I practice inpatient palliative care.
Wow.
And as part of that care,
yes,
you play the flute. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well,
that's a part of it.
Yes. I mean, I have.
You get points for the segue. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, the interest in Native American flute kind of like started actually about the same time as a parallel to the palliative care, but then I thought that hey, maybe there's some way that these two could work together, that there could be synergies between the two.
And that sounded fascinating to me. So, can you tell us a little bit about your how that's come out and how that's worked out and what you see the results of this are?
Yeah. So, the use of musical instruments to play music to patients, to help them feel better, to help reduce pain, anxiety, things like that, is called therapeutic music. Mm-hmm. And there are different programs to train folks to do this. So I found one of the programs, MHTP, Music for Healing and Therapy. Music for Healing and Transitions Program. Mm-hmm. And played Native American flute in that program to do this. And actually I'm still actually a student of it right now. Hmm. You have to play 45 playing hours at the bedside. I'm working through at a very, very slow pace.
Yeah, so you're not just going to do that all in a week.
But so that's what I'm doing. And actually like the two main areas I'm playing in right now in the hospital are the palliative care unit, which is our inpatient unit for largely like hospice patients, and then the emergency department. Playing the palliative care unit is kind of what I would expect, probably what you guys might expect. I mean, there are patients who are, many of them are end of life. Sometimes, I mean, they're having some symptoms, but for the most part, reasonably well controlled. Mm-hmm. And then you play the Native American flute music. It's very relaxing, and you know, they appear to be relaxed, and you know, it's kind of a nice situation. Mm-hmm, you know, it's kind of satisfying. But the emergency department is a very, very interesting environment to play
in. I wouldn't have guessed that would be a.
Pardon me, but I'm just like I always think in terms of sketches. Yeah. So I'm just like seeing like an ER kind of scenario where someone like you know everyone comes in, the doctor's all around a guy on a gurney, and they're like he's got four gunshot wounds, and then you just appear like from below the gurney, like playing your flute, and you just pop up, and you're like. And then you pop back down. Anyway, go on.
Like a Coca Cola.
Right. So there's so many like interesting aspects of it, like just from like the musician's aspect of like the challenges of playing in the environment, and then like seeing the responses to the music from both the patients, and I wasn't quite expecting this, but from like the staff, which have been like amazingly receptive. I mean, there's at least initially there's some like sort of like curiosity and like
incredulity.
Yeah, exactly.
I would imagine there'd be a fair amount of incredulity.
And they're like, "What is going on exactly?"
WTF, mate?
Right, and then there's And then there's like the ED staff, like, who know me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so there's the familiarity, like, oh, I know who that is. And yeah, you know, but he's doing something kind of weird. And like, but let's see what happens.
Sure.
And then there's like, you know, you're bringing up the you know, this sort of like scenario. And I did that actually like 2 weeks ago, but it was like a trauma patient.
Jeez,
and
it's so, not funny, but it is.
And so like, there were also like, you know, the other departments who are coming to participate in the care, like the surgical team, like they're there.
And so it's not a case where you're playing the flute instead of having medical treatment. Yeah, it's in addition.
Yeah,
to...
yeah, yeah. And so I wasn't
he's
even
doing it at the same time. Yes, scalpel.
So yeah, actually, it was like I was passing through. I just played in the palliative care unit. And I was kind of like on my way out, and the nurse in the critical care bay is like, can you play the flute? Can you play the flute? And like, what am I going to say? Like, no.
No, yeah,
like,
no. I'm going to play myself out.
Yes, I'm out of here. So yeah, as I break out the flute and I start playing it and I go into the room and I'm also wearing like basically like a blazer, a bow tie, like it's like slack. So like definitely not like, you know, medical attire.
You look like a professor.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah. And so like, so many of them are kind of like sort of giving me the eye, like as I'm walking in, I'm not playing, you know, yet.
Right, right.
They're kind of like sort of looking at me like,
escape from the,
like,
mental?
What's going on here? And then I start playing, and then like, I didn't even notice this so much because I was focused on the patient. You know, how you do it is you kind of focus in, you kind of like, you know, center your intention and, you know, on helping the patient. And I did my best to ignore like the other folks, as I don't want to be distracted by those other folks. But I did kind of notice this, and also I got some feedback later from the radiation technologist, radiology technologist who had come like to shoot some X-rays. But it's like, did you see like when you started playing, like everybody like just stopped what they were doing, and they're just like listening to you and watching you play. Like, wow, that's pretty cool.
It's got to be great for the families who are in an emergency room situation.
Yeah, yeah. And right? So that's kind of like the side benefits is like family, the staff, you know, they get, you know, chilled out and calmed down and relaxed. Yeah. So it's a really good benefit for the whole thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, as somebody who's, you know, been in the ER and spent maybe a night or a night with someone who was in the ER, it's a very uncomfortable environment.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to be there.
Right.
Who's there.
Right.
And it's often just filled with unpleasant sounds.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, having something like this would be, I know, it sounds like somebody should be studying this.
Well,
if they're not.
Yeah,
they are, right?
Well, kind of. I mean, it's, you know, definitely not kind of like, you know, the front lines of medicine that everyone's dedicating like research resources to.
It's not getting
to
the research dollars,
yeah,
which is usually what the
yeah
thing is.
That's kind of the, yeah, it would be the big driver thing. So, but
this ice is nothing.
But super. I definitely do plan to study it. I mean, you know, that's kind of like the part of my sort of the academic side of my job is to, you know, to ideally research this sort of stuff. So
cool.
It is my hope to research it. And you know, and I'm a physician. I'm a scientist. Mm-hmm. I believe in the evidence.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm, you know, well, going into this, I was somewhat skeptical of it, and you know, maybe this is just part of the education, but I started to get more on board with the idea. The same day, like in the critical care bay, the nurse is then like, and I was preparing to go after I played for that guy, the nurse is like, hey, can come over here, can you help this lady, can you help this lady? So The other patient had just had a stroke. She couldn't speak and she was like freaking out. So her heart rate was very, very fast. And so the nurse Joe, who has become like a great advocate for this, you know, therapeutic music, like he's the one who kind of, you know, asked me to play. So I'm like, okay, you know, again, I can't just say, no, John, I'm out of here. And so this is in the middle of the, you know, crazy, chaotic, like, critical care bay. Like, of all the emergency department, like, this is probably the, you know, loudest, you know, most disruptive, like, least relaxing.
This is what you see on TV environment. In the procedural medical.
Yeah, stuff, exactly. And so, like, all this sort of craziness is going on in, you know, the other areas. And I'm playing the therapeutic music for this lady. I think altogether I played for her almost half an hour. But maybe, like, halfway through, like, you could visually see a change in her. Mm-hmm. Like, that she was starting to relax. She'd close her eyes, and you know, mm-hmm. the sort of tension in her face was kind of melting away. And she's on the monitors too, because it's the critical care bay. And like her heart rate is going down.
That's
her
so cool.
Respiratory rate is going down. And like then, you know, then there's the scientist in me. Like,
right.
when you see that, it's like, oh my God, like it really works.
Right.
Like, and it was almost magical. Like I'm just playing the flute. And like she's responding to it. And yeah, and then she, you know, she closed her eyes and she went to sleep. And all the meanwhile, like, there's all this, like, nutso craziness going on. Like, another trauma patient comes in, like, all this resuscitation going on across the way. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, this is going to, like, just mess up the whole thing that I just created. But no, it didn't. It's unbelievable. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things that you kind of touched on when you were talking about that is not just the effects on the patients, but on the staff as well. Because, I can imagine that an ER is going to be a very stressful
tense
environment to work in.
Yeah.
And just having, a sort of just relaxing or calming or soothing or, you know, whatever that positive effect is on the staff could reap benefits as well.
Oh, yeah. I think so. Yeah. ED nurses like are so important, as you can imagine, to the to the care of the patients and to making the whole thing work. And I think that like the turnover is relative to like other areas is pretty high, just because I think the
gotta be burnout.
The stress levels are so high. I mean, and you know there are nurses that for whom this is like their career, and you know they have great longevity, but you know. I guess some of the younger nurses, they might start and get some experience, and then they're out of there.
So I'm going to hit you with a follow-up question on this.
Yes, the man in the striped shirt, yes.
Now, what is the difference that you've either perceived or you've read about or studied in some way between having a live person there playing music and just popping in a CD?
Yes. So that's a very good question. So
yes.
So I mean, if you don't have the luxury of, you know, a musician playing live therapeutic music for you at the bedside, I mean, I think that's second best. I mean, I don't have anyone playing for me at home, and so you know, I ask.
I know a guy.
So I ask Alexa, hey, play some relaxing music, Alexa.
Never mind, Alexa. She's like right there.
Oh, nice. Alexa, turn it down. So the benefits of therapeutic music, live therapeutic music, is you have the musician who is like determining like what your like clinical situation, condition is. Deciding what the music is that will kind of best help you kind of configure the music to that, and then also see how the patient responds to it and then adjust the music accordingly. So
tempo, musical style, volume,
all that stuff. The other part of it also is that when you have, like live music with the instrument like right next to you, there are like vibrations, like, you know, there's the frequency and the vibrations that, you know, and this is a little bit of the part where I'm a little bit skeptical about.
You're talking to two performers, so you're going to find us probably on the side of this. So go ahead.
I get the physical, like energy impacts on the body. I mean, there, you know, sound is vibration of of particles, and that energy, that vibration is definitely like hitting your body and causing some sort of effect physically on the molecules of your body. The question is though, like, what is the actual, effect of that? Right. I mean, of that. That's what I'm not certain about.
Well, and the scientist in you, of course, is going to be skeptical. So first of all, like, being an audiophile, I put a ton of research and money and time into trying to make recorded music sound live. Like, that's the irony of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, because there's sometimes I'm like, if I took all the money I spent on this stuff, I just go to concerts nonstop. And, but it's different, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of conquering the limitations of recorded sound. But ultimately, that's what you're striving towards, right? Is that experience of expansiveness and that vibration. But I will say that I've read a lot about the folk storytelling history of our like species, right? And the importance of storytelling in general. And it's abundantly clear to me, if you really dive into that, that we are hardwired as a human animal to have someone engage with us, either one-on-one or one with a group.
Right.
And as performers, Mike and I have talked about this many times, and I'm curious about this. After a show, even a show that isn't, and I don't really perform much anymore. This is my performance at this point. But when we were performing, like, I would be exhausted by the end. Like, just the give and take from the audience. Like, there was a palpable energy exchange that would happen that would be exhausted by the end. Do you ever find that you're just more so maybe than the sum of playing? It's a different kind of thing for you, though, for that kind of performance. Where you're really engaging with one person in that way.
Right. That's a good question.
Do you do a lot of like making eye contact with the person you're playing for initially? Or
be hard in palliative care.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on the condition of the It depends on the condition of the patient, because therapeutic music is for like all conditions of patients. Okay. So like, I mean, like you could, you know, like you would be like one. I mean, you know, basically when nothing's going on. I mean, but like
there's that
would
be one. Something.
There's always something going on. To the other end where, you know, I guess there's different categories, but, you know, someone who's totally unresponsive to someone who is like in a ton of pain. Like, so, but in terms of eye contact, like, at least I try not to, because I get distracted. Cause then like, if I'm like making the eye contact, then that makes me start to think about like, oh, like, what are they thinking about? You know, what are they looking at? The flu, you know, are they looking at like my nose? And
it is different. It is a different thing, which is
fine. But there's some point either before you start playing or during the course of playing where there's some sort of acknowledgement of I'm here and I'm playing for you. And I'm trying to put words to this, but
Well, I mean,
it's a difficult thing to put words to.
If there's someone there to talk to, if they're like unconscious, like I'll still like talk to them, introduce myself, say what's going to happen. I mean, we assume in palliative care that patients can hear, like even if they're unconscious, even though they can't respond to you, that they can hear at some level they can hear. And that's what we tell families, like, you know, keep talking to your loved one, let them know you're here, that you love them. They may not be able to respond to you, but you know, they're receiving something. So when I walk in, even to the unresponsive patient, I'll tell them. Often there's family around, or they may be, you know, they may be alert and be able to have a conversation. And so I kind of give an introduction, like, you know, this is who I am, this is what I'm going to do for you, this is the purpose. And so there, that's where the kind of like more like two-way
exchange
happens. And then after that, you know, it's more of like my delivery of the therapeutic music to the patient and then kind of seeing how they respond.
I'm in no way trying to draw a parallel between like being funny on stage, right, to what you're doing. But I'm speaking more to the skeptic in you. I have spent a little bit of time researching and talking to people, storytellers, and Neil Gaiman's a great, you know, resource on this. And I one of my favorite books ever is a Bill Moyers interview with Joseph Campbell, Power of Myth, which is fascinating, talking about myth and the human means of communication. Yes. But I think that there is absolutely something to a live performance of anything over, you know, over a recording.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something else, and I definitely want
to. Not to mention that your job is in how people read each other and react to each other. I mean, that's like.
Well, I was DISC certified, which is like Myers-Briggs. So, like, it's a very, very, very specific line of interest for me. Like, I've learned and tested all sorts of, like, certified ways of engaging people.
Wow.
And everyone has different ways, and you kind of meet in different halfway points and all that kind of stuff. But are you familiar with the so-called ASMR concept?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you run into anyone who experiences it, or have you run into any kind of research on it? I experience it very strongly, and I don't often get to talk to anyone in the medical industry who even knows what it is.
What do you mean? Now, what do you mean by experience it? I mean, maybe I'm thinking of something different. I'm thinking of that thing that kind of like determines what your personality or something is.
I completely switched gears. Sorry.
Just change tracks on you.
Yeah. So ASMR is.
I thought that was another one of those.
Well, because DISC, Myers Briggs, and ASMR. Yeah, it just rolls really. No, this is totally selfish interest. So ASMR is that phenomenon that's big on YouTube, like people whispering.
Oh yeah.
And scratching stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I subscribed to one of those.
Oh, my gosh.
Though I haven't listened to it in a long time.
Oh, which one?
No.
That Russian lady.
But do you know her name? Is that her?
Oh, there are multiple Russian ladies.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, it's
people making a living at this.
Well, apparently it's one of the big ones. The blonde. She's like a blonde.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Does she do a lot of stuff with hair? Like
brushes? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I know what you're talking about.
But I do respond to that.
Oh. You do? Like, so you get that too?
It's weird.
So what are your triggers?
Like, which of the things?
Yeah, which of the sounds?
Hairbrush, I think, did it.
Okay.
The whispering.
You're triggered by whispering. Okay.
It's like, oh my God. It's like I can feel like the hair standing up on the back.
And people don't experience it. There's no way to explain it. Because inevitably people start to think it's sexual. It's like, it's not in any way sexual. It is just instant relaxation.
Yeah. Yes.
It's funny because I have the just complete opposite reaction to that.
He does.
It grates on me. I want to punch something.
It's so weird. Nero, my friend Nero is like that. He can't stand it. Yeah.
Well, I suppose, right, if you didn't have the response, it'd be like, stop, you know, doing this goofy, bizarro stuff.
Well, it makes Erica angry.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's the same thing for me. It's
like
weird.
She has dysophonia to some degree, so I wonder if it's related, but like you're misophonia or whatever, but you don't, and you like it really grates on them.
Wow.
I'm more what I've gotten into lately was I'm always was big on like head massages.
Okay.
With a mic really up close to get that feeling of the hair, the sound of the hair. But what I've discovered is you can really cheat that with microphone scratching.
Huh.
So that's what I've been listening to a lot lately. Like that's my I need to relax, microphone scratching. And there's a ton of it.
Okay, I was gonna say like, do you scratch your own microphone?
You can't do it yourself.
Oh, you can't.
No, there's something intrinsic about it.
Wow,
weird.
Yeah,
that is weird. That's cool. Oh my gosh.
I was curious, but the medical community is bare. There's one fMRI research study that the results aren't released yet.
Okay.
And it's gonna take another year or two to release the results, but like, there's no validation for it.
Huh.
But it's so real, and no joke. Yeah. Like 13, unpopular, overweight kid, not a lot of friends, started to experience it. Yeah. Like the popular kids would give each other like back rubs and I'd feel like something.
Mm.
And I thought I had a superpower where I could tell what other people were feeling.
Yeah.
So like for years, I never told anyone. I just thought I had this like power. And I was like, this is weird. I'm not going to say anything about it. And then one day, a couple years ago, someone was describing it. I'm like, oh my God, that's it. And then I discovered it all on YouTube and I was like, yes. But, yeah, okay, well, so, but you don't, there's no medical, like...
Well, I mean, Not that I'm aware of. I can't remember how I first learned about it. I think I read an article about it. And then in the article, they said, yeah, there's this Russian lady who is like one of the top ones. And then, so I checked it out and I was like, oh, this is so weird. But like, yeah.
I'll give you some names for your triggers. I got some good names.
I think we should have a little musical interlude. I think that'd be a good time.
Just ASMR, cut to ASMR right now, and then we lose half the people listening. Eric is like, no.
Real music, not that.
Okay. So speaking of real music, you won a pretty big award.
Well, I haven't won the award, but I won a nomination.
Oh, you won a nomination?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
With everybody's help, I might win the award.
Wait, can we help? Is this something we can do?
Well, I mean, it's okay. So it's the Native American Music Awards.
Okay.
Which NativeAmericanMusicAwards.com is the website.
Because we will set up a bot and just
that probably could work.
That's not the spirit of the voting, but sure.
And so they're called the NAMMYs. You know, is the like the Grammys and NAMMYs, and. and so I have a CD, Peaceful Journey, which is of, solo Native American flute music for healing and comfort. And, so it was nominated for Native American Music Award, in the category Native Heart, which means non-native. So there's six of us nominees who are non-native that are competing for the award in the Native Heart category, Native American Music Awards. Yep.
Nice.
Yep. And so the award ceremony is coming up this Saturday, October 14, in the Seneca Niagara Casino, which is going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to be there Saturday. But the voting goes all the way up until Friday, and it's a public vote.
It goes up until Friday the 13th?
Yes.
This will air long after that.
Okay. All right. Well,
dang it.
I'll put something up for
our dozen people.
But it's basically a popularity vote. So the more votes you get, then it's how you win. But it's still such an honor to be nominated. Can we get
a sample here?
Yeah, sure. All right. Let me break out a flute here.
Yes, I've never used this microphone to actually capture music, which is apparently quite good at.
Okay.
Do you need any more room, or you?
No, I'm all right.
Okay.
So this flute that I'm taking out here is one of my favorites. This is actually a real Native American flute, as opposed to what you might call Native American style flute, because most flute makers are actually non-native.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so technically speaking, you'd call it a Native American style flute.
Is that a duck?
It's a bird of some kind.
Oh, it's a bird? Okay. Yeah, okay. I see it. It looks more like a bird from that angle.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Hawk Henrys is the flute maker. He lives in Maine. And, yeah, this is one of my favorite flutes. It has a very lovely sound. And, yeah, when I told him that I was going to play music for, like, for healing... He picked the particular woods. I'm trying to remember now what wood this is, but yeah, he selected the different woods that would kind of have healing properties, and
that's really interesting.
And also he's very unique in his in the way he builds the flutes. Like most flute makers will use power tools to make them, and these he makes entirely by hand.
Wow.
And so, beautiful. No power tools. Yeah, it's really like a work of art. So yeah, this is one of my treasures, but yeah, I love the sound of this too.
Thank you. Well, I feel better.
Thank you.
That was amazing.
Actually, I feel more drunk. So... That's weird.
Is it just the resonance of that that's so... It's a very striking sound. But very, you know, calming at the same time. It's just, it sort of like goes through you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of one of the things, you know, getting back to the therapeutic music is that, you know, the sound, like, you know, just sort of permeates you when it's live. And I was thinking about kind of like your, you know, your audiophile, you know, like headphones that you're talking about. Like, I'm sure if you had like, you know, like a big sort of speaker setup, and you know, when you have like music playing like that and like, you know, the vibration kind of goes through you, it has a very, you know, added impact beyond just like, you know, the headphones.
Yes, it's just so much more difficult and pricey to get a fully enveloping 3D sound field.
Yeah.
I mean, it's expensive enough to do it with headphones. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's insane to get it. To get the quality of a high-end set of headphones and speakers is just so expensive.
I see.
It's a shame. Uh-huh. But we'll just have you come play in my basement.
Right.
And now I know that if you go to leave, I'll just be like, hey, Mike's got a hurt knee. Can you
play? Yeah, play some
therapy. Hey, I stubbed my toe. Can you play for me?
Right.
And we'll just keep guilting you into staying.
Well, and it'll add to my time because I gotta get the 45 hours. So, one of the things, there's different things that make it so nice, and one of them is the scale. It's a minor pentatonic scale, is the basic scale, and that has that very melancholic but kind of like flowing tones. Like one of the wonderful things about that scale is like you can play the notes in any order and it sounds very lovely, very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't have to think, oh, I got like which note should I play next that won't be jarring. Like they all sound nice, whatever order you play them, and that's also, I think, what makes this a wonderful instrument for everybody, because it's great for improvisation. Like you don't have to, you know, know, oh, I have to play, you know, these notes to make it sound great. Like you just play.
You can bypass music theory.
Yeah, exactly.
To some degree.
Exactly, right. And so you can be very expressive. You can improvise. You know, the expression is like play from the heart. And, you know, over time, you know, you develop this muscle memory where, you know, you kind of know like, oh, if I want to make a certain sound, like the fingers just kind of move to that position and the sound comes out. But it makes it so accessible to everybody to make beautiful music. And then the other thing that kind of helps is it's like a two-chamber. There's two chambers to this. There's a wall right under this block or bird, if you know, like they can see it's carved as a bird. Mm-hmm. And then there's a channel over the top, a very flat channel that connects this first chamber to the big chamber with the hole.
So that simulates the reed.
Well, and then there's a... like a fipple mechanism, kind of like a whistle mechanism.
Oh, I didn't see there was that. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's kind of like the whistle sound.
Oh.
And then because the air is traveling through this tiny channel to get to it, it really lets you control like the volume of it. And so that adds, you know, you're talking about like dynamics in terms of like loudness, softness.
Mm-hmm.
That allows that additional expressivity. So it's a very, it's a very beautiful sounding instrument.
And the vibrations in wood versus metal.
Yeah,
and this is so much thicker than like what I think of as like a metal flute.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, the traditionally the woods used are like cedar, which is a softer wood.
Right.
You can make them out of any wood.
It just gets harder the harder the wood, I'd imagine.
Right, to make. And then the harder woods have more like a crisper, kind of cleaner, sharper sound.
I would expect that because it's going to be tighter. Like the material's tight, more like metal than a soft.
Well, the vibration would be faster with the...
Right. So you'd be getting a higher pitch. Because this also seems... Because I think flute, especially in a small space, I would think more shrill, like a metal flute.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Hmm. Just because they're a tight instrument when you think about that. But this, it didn't have that at all.
Yeah.
So this immediately reminds me of when we were in Sedona.
Mm.
And we were hiking out in Sedona, and you were there.
Oh, with the chimney stacks and the
roof. We were in this area. Yeah, we were off on a hike, and we could be, this guy was so far away,
so
we
far
could
away.
Barely even see that it was a person, and he was like way up on one of the tall chimney sort of stacks. Cool. And he was playing flute.
How cool.
It was. It must have been something very similar to this.
It sounded. It had to be. This is a contemporary instrument, so they're all very, very similar.
And even though he was so far, I mean, we could hear him very clearly.
The sound traveled so much better than the visual did. Mm-hmm. It was so odd. Mm-hmm.
That's neat.
Yeah. It was a very Sedona experience.
Yeah,
and so that's kind of like one of the classic sort of like environments or sounds to, you know, sound environments to play in is like the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have these sort of like, you know, echoes and what we call like reverberation.
Good acoustics, man.
Yeah, yeah. And so...
So that's the next thing, right? Yeah. To get some of your patients into a canyon.
Right. Yes.
Play for them and see what the reverberations...
I need all of you go to High Falls, not after a rainstorm, right now.
Yeah. But it's the same. It's the same thing like... So this like these reverberation like effect is kind of like in the bathroom, like if you sing in the bathroom or if you like play an instrument in the bathroom, and it has that kind of like rich sort of echoey sound.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like what you get playing in the canyon. So otherwise, you add it on electronically.
Right, DSPs, digital.
Yeah,
sound.
That's right. That's right.
All right. There are so many things we want to talk
about.
That
is a long list.
There's no way we're getting off to all of this.
Can I ask you about the bees? I just want to know about the bees.
Yes. So that like a lot of my interest kind of like started on some sort of, I don't know, random whimsy. I can't remember specifically when it started, but in med school in Ohio State is when it's really started to kind of pick up, and I think pretty much everywhere there's like beekeepers clubs or associations. And so I've looked up, I found the Beekeepers Association in Columbus, Ohio, and they're often like really good like educational outreach to the community, you know, whoever's interested, you know, there's classes that they give. And
that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think I took a class with them, and they give you a suit to put on, and you go check out the beehives, and like, oh, this is pretty cool. And then...
I'm impervious.
That's right, yeah. And then, you know, like a lot of my interests, like, okay, you know, that there was that, and then got busy doing other things. And
but
then
you have bees.
And then so after living in Rochester a while, and it's like, oh, like it sort of came up somehow again, like maybe maybe we should get bees.
And then Lisa rolls her eyes at you.
Yeah.
Your long-suffering wife.
That's right. And then so there's the Ontario Finger Lakes Beekeepers Association, which has great education, community outreach, and all that stuff. And so I went to some of their meetings, and then they have a class in the spring, like late winter, spring, where they teach you how to raise bees, and they help you get the equipment, and that they give you a mentor and kind of get things set up. And yeah, so we have a beehive in our backyard in Brighton. We've had either one or two hives, depending.
Say hive, do you mean like the box?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, each box is a hive. Yep.
So you harvest the honey then?
Yeah, every now and then. It's for whatever reason, it's been a struggle for the bees. I mean, it could be because where we are in Brighton, could be I don't know what it is, but
bees are getting shafted.
Yeah,
generally,
yeah,
so, you know.
and so they haven't. Always survive the winter and then kind of have to start over again.
Oh.
And pretty much like when you first start the hive, so this is like in the spring, like a brand new one, you're starting with a fairly small population. I mean, it's I think about like, I think it's about like 10,000, 5 or 10,000 bees.
Where do you
get
them?
Just a tiny amount.
Yeah.
But
where do you just come up with 10,000 bees?
Yeah. So
do they come in a box? You get them on Amazon?
Yeah. I haven't checked on Amazon. Amazon Prime.
Let's not give Jeff Bezos any ideas here.
Bezos.
Damn it! Oh, the idea. We can't unthink this now, guys. Do you get them from the beekeepers?
Yeah. So either like a local beekeeper will get into the business of producing these what we call nucleus hives or nukes to sell. Which I mean, but it's hard.
Just to recap, you're saying that you know people who are in the business of selling nukes. Just want to make sure I've heard you correctly.
Which country are we talking about? But pretty much they're like massive producers of bees in the South because they don't have the winter problems. Right. I mean, the bees just keep going year round. And so they just make mass quantities of bees, and then they ship them up north. So the club, the Beekeepers Association.
So it takes like 10,000 bees to get a hive.
To start. But then, you know, you get into like 50, 100,000.
How do you count them? Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
Do you weigh it? I don't know. Is that
So what you're really... as winter approaches, I mean, there's nothing you can really...
Winter is coming.
Right? There's nothing we can do about it. I mean, it's like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But we've all read Game of Thrones, except Mike. Go
on. But you basically look, like, you inspect the frames, and you see, like how much pollen is in there, how much honey is in there, how much brood, which are like, you know, the baby, the larva, the baby bees.
Kind of extrapolate based on that.
And then also you kind of like very grossly, like you'll look at how many bees are in the hive. Are they like spilling out of the hive when you open it up? Or is it just like, you know, not a lot? And the other thing is by weight. I think you're supposed to have kind of like 50 pounds or something of, I don't know if this is correct, but like 50 pounds of honey to be able to last over the winter. You know, that's the food that they eat over the winter.
For X number of bees.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
Never thought about like a beekeeping pissing contest. It's like, I got 60,000 bees. No, you don't. Oh, yeah? I can prove it. Look at all the honey. Look at my brood count, bro.
All right.
Okay, it's Mike. Lightning round.
All right. Bow ties.
Yes.
Yes.
Was that a question? Because that's really just a statement.
How many bow ties do you have?
Oh.
That's a question.
All right. I probably have...
You have to think about this.
Well,
because
I counted them some time ago, and I forget what it was. But it's
10,000. Oh, bees. I mean, bow ties. No.
I think it's two... I mean, it's over two dozen. It's probably maybe like three dozen. I mean, it's not... It's you know, it's more than a few.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's your thing.
Yeah, I like
some people
ties.
Are into shoes and they have dozens of pairs of shoes.
That's cool. Do you have any of the? Do you have one of the feather ones? Have you seen those?
No. What is that?
Oh, you haven't heard of it? When we were in
this guy.
When we were in South Carolina, we were at this place and apparently they're making bow ties out of feathers.
Really?
We'll show you a picture. They look really cool.
Really?
You're gonna have to have
one. I am. They don't look cheesy or weird.
No, they don't. They look really neat.
Huh.
I'll show you a picture.
I may have to get one then.
Yeah.
Next question.
Tell us about the mace.
Oh.
So many ways to interpret that.
It's the way you're hoping
the
it is.
The mace.
The Game of Thrones way.
Oh my gosh. Where did the mace come from? I don't know where it came. I don't know.
You don't know where it came.
Well, I mean,
from.
I don't know where the idea. I don't know where.
Sir,
the
you have a mace in this car, and I pulled you over, and you're telling me you don't know where this mace came from.
I don't know where
from.
The idea came from. Oh! I know.
Officer,
it was from kettlebells.
Okay.
I don't know where the kettlebells came from, but basically, so
many levels to the story.
I've not had great success with gyms.
Okay.
The hospital, for instance, is great because they have a gym like right in the hospital, and
is it a good gym?
Yeah, it's not bad.
Okay,
it's not bad.
A lot of in on-site gyms usually aren't that good.
No, it's pretty good. They've got it's pretty good setup, and they've been improving it over the years. And like when I was an intern in my emergency medicine residency, it was such a deal. It was like $5 a month, you know, for the gym membership. It's right there in the hospital. I got it, and like I never went.
No, it's
never
too cheap. No, I'm serious.
Well, I guess.
If they charge you $50 a month, you would have gone more.
Maybe. I don't know. But
they've done studies on this. Well, the closer to free something is, the less important it is.
The less you value it. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Well, that sounds sciencey, so we have to agree.
Right. And I am pushing up my glasses when I say that. Mm-hmm.
And I know they're dedicated people who obviously.
And then there are the gym people. Exercise. Yeah.
And then there's me who's like, okay, I've done my work and like. Now I want to leave the hospital. I don't want to stay longer in the hospital.
Yeah.
But even so, like we have membership, like family membership at various gyms over the years, and like I pretty much never go. I mean, like kitty.
Sorry, my cat is meowing.
Yeah, unless like my wife says like, come on, and you know, and I'll go like once in a blue moon. So
keep talking. She wants to be played with. I need to get out. Get out of here. Go.
So I've tried to figure out like what can I do to exercise at home, and I've had in terms of like what's worked. I've had greatest success with the 7-minute workout. You guys know what that is. So yeah, the New York Times, like they consulted these whatever exercise physiologists, and they crafted this scientific, you know, collection of exercises that you could complete in 7 minutes with just you, a wall, and a chair, and the floor, and then you could do this in 7 minutes.
You heard 7 minutes in scientific, and you were sold.
Yeah, yeah, and like
and
yeah.
New York Times.
That's yeah. Right. And so I was pretty good with that. But then I wanted to like do more.
Right.
I had like dumbbells, and you know, it was okay. But I wanted something. You know, something that you know, got me more interested, more motivated, and somehow I came across like kettlebells.
Okay, sure.
And so, so I started getting into that, and then, well, you know, there's social media, there's all these connections between things, and so somehow kettlebells were connected to steel mace. Oh, no, now I remember. So the company that I found these like really freaky kettlebells from is Onnit, Onnit. And so I got like this harpy face kettlebell from them. But then they also made this thing called the steel mace. And like,
which is a steel
mace. Which is right, exactly. It's a steel mace.
It's
like
a very descriptive name.
It's a rod with like a sphere on the end. And like, whoa, like, what is this thing? Like, how do you exercise with this thing? And so I've just found it, like, intriguing. It's, you know, a very dynamic form of exercise. And it's just, you know, it's you know, like Game of Thrones. Well, actually, they didn't introduce the mace till. Well, you don't watch.
I don't care. Spoil anything. I don't care.
Well, the mace was introduced in the most recent season. But
well, not a mace.
Well, I mean, well, hammer. Hammer. Yeah. So
picky.
D&D, whatever.
Yeah, I'm an old D&D kid. Stuff, they are two different. They may both be blunt, but they are two different weapons, sir. I will have you know. Come on.
But I thought it was like it was so cool. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna get this thing. I mean, they looked at the exercise and you know they're very dynamic. It's like, yeah, this
it's
is something
probably really heavy and it's probably great for like forearm workout.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one I got wasn't heavy. It was like the lightest.
No, but I mean, any weapon is going to be heavier than like a 10-pound weight that you just kind of do.
Right, right. Just in your yeah.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean by dynamic.
Yeah. So yeah. So you know, it's yeah, exactly. So, So then I got into that, and so I got the lighter steel mace, and I got the next heavier one, and then one of my like local like arts community friends.
Keep talking.
Eric Lehman, like he posted about this mace that is actually produced locally at Wolf Brigade Gym, and it's a pretty like cool looking mace. Anyway, that's my latest. It's my latest mace, 10 kilogram mace, and yeah, I work out with that, and like because it's so. Like fun, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not just it's just, you know, the dumbbells. I mean, it's like, you know, you're like moving this thing around.
You know, just for the record, I absolutely love dumbbell curls.
Okay, well,
just letting you
enjoy,
know.
enjoy. But yeah, so I love the steel mace.
So in Zombie Apocalypse, I think I'm coming to your place just for a bludgeoning weapon.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough to go around. The three of us. We have enough for the three of us.
And if it's a zombie wearing bow tie apocalypse, we can come to your place and then blend in.
That's so right.
It's perfect. We are definitely abutting a long episode here. Is there anything you would like to talk about or ask us or anything? By the way, you never would know you're an introvert. I think you did.
We talked a lot about it.
Cool yeah, stuff. And I still have a dozen things.
Yeah, that's why I was nixing him. I'm like, looking at, no, just leave, let him. He's got to go home at some point.
One more question. Do you sleep?
For the most part, I do like sleeping.
Well, no, that's not what he asked.
I do sacrifice quite a bit of sleep, which makes it kind of rough, but I'd make an effort to get at least some sleep.
What's a full night's sleep for you? Because it's actually it varies a lot by person.
Well, I think acceptable for me. I mean, like sort of minimum acceptable for me is like six and a half hours. Awesome. However, I will try to go for more if I can.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I could easily sleep 8 hours.
I was waiting for you to say like 3 hours.
Yeah, because you're some weird person. Yeah.
This week, actually, a couple of the nights have been like three, 4 hours.
All right. Well, we won't keep you any longer. Finish as much of the drink as you'd like, and then.
Oh, okay. I'll finish this thing off. It's tasty.
This is probably the most sober conversation you've ever had with me, I think.
Probably.
I feel like I always feel bad. Just so you know, I generally feel bad when I have a fun time, but I drink a lot at the soccer meetups because I don't get a hangover. Oh, nice. Usually Mel drives us, so I'm like, well, I'm not driving, so I don't really, I can go for broke because I got a kid and I don't do this very often.
And the sake is so yummy.
It's very easy to drink. But then there's usually the next day I'm like, I'll go back and be like, did I do anything particularly stupid? No. Oh yeah, I think I was shouting and talking about some book I read to Jefferson and Lisa and just making a general dumbass of myself. So you talking to you is one of my only regrets ever after soccer meetups, because I'm always thinking I think I was making an ass of myself.
Oh no, never. We love talking with
you. You keep asking for Erica and I for recommendations on stuff. So it has to be hitting the mark at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
I do often think
a lot of fun.
I don't really talk to Jefferson sober.
Okay, one last question. What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh man,
this is technically the episode before Halloween for us.
Sheesh.
Yeah, we need to talk about nitrate films.
My favorite scary movie.
Right. Well, you think about that for a second. I'm gonna go on the record and say that in the last week or so we saw The Invitation, which I really enjoyed. It's a suburban sort of horror film.
Okay.
I think it's from last year, maybe. But I would recommend it. Mel didn't like it as much as I did. And we finally saw 10 Cloverfield Lane.
That was good.
It was really good. It surprised me.
Yeah.
It didn't do things I thought it was going to do.
John Goodman was excellent in it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
Strongly recommend it for anybody that hasn't seen it.
Yeah. It's unfortunately the title ties it to a quasi-franchise that it has nothing to... There's no correlation whatsoever to it. So, yeah. Yeah, Tom Cloverfield Lane was a surprisingly good movie.
But The Invitation was really good. So, a small budget indie, very, ratcheting up the tension until things happen.
I got something similar to that. Last night we watched Independence Day Resurgence. Just a very small budget movie. Really slowly ratcheted up the horrible acting, horrible screenwriting, medium special effects, pretty much not a great experience overall. Right. But a horror movie in its own right.
So what's your scary movie pick?
I have to, as you might have guessed, I haven't watched a lot of the recent scary movies. Like what my friend, my coworker was telling me that, for instance, The Ring is the Japanese one is really, really creepy, scary. Just because of anyway. So I haven't watched a lot of the recent stuff. So I'd have to say, I'm going to give two answers.
Right.
So the first answer is I don't know, favorite is the right word, but was most, had
visceral.
The greatest impact,
okay.
Right, visceral impact for me was as a kid watching The Omen. Because...
The original.
With Gregory Peck.
Uh-huh.
Because, like, you know, you're a kid, what do you know? But like, there's all this prophecy, it's in the Bible, like it could be real. And like, this is like, this is like horrible. This is like a disaster, you know, just as it's going to happen. Is like, it had me petrified. And it wasn't like, you know, the scared feeling like, oh, like there's something under my bed.
Right.
But it's scared like the world is going to
end. Ecumenically, yeah. Philosophically, it's like, terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, so.
Definitely a classic, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. And then in terms of like, I guess what's my favorite, actually, it's probably the one, the shirt. I mean, if this is a horror, I guess it would be considered a horror movie, but House or House.
Japanese one. Yeah, so, it's like bonkers, okay. Crazy. Yes,
so. I tried, man. I tried to watch that. I was like, I'm checking out of this. Yeah. I cannot do it.
So I haven't seen it, but okay. I want to see it.
So it is bananas.
It is. It's not a horror movie in the classic horror movie sense, but like, you know, people die. I mean, so it's just kind of like...
It's got weird gore.
Yeah.
Like,
it's a haunted house. Weird. It's a haunted house. People die. And so this t-shirt that I'm wearing is from House... Lisa and I saw it at the Dryden Theater. I can't remember what the theme was, but they showed this movie.
Gonzo Japanese horror movie.
Yeah. Probably something like that.
Cool.
And I mean, it's like kitschy, stupid, like, but like, it's so out there. I mean, it was so bizarre. I mean, I loved it. Lisa hates it. yeah.
Nice. All right. We got some good picks there.
What's your favorite horror movie, Mike?
My favorite? Yeah. I don't know.
Or the scariest, one or the other.
The two come to mind, and one is The Exorcist 3, which we watched with you guys.
Great, great movie.
Love that one.
Yeah, weird story. It's really
George
good.
C. Scott.
Yeah.
Amazing job. And Prince of
Darkness. Yeah, you've been talking about that for
John
years.
John Carpenter.
Hmm.
But yeah, those are my two favorites.
Mine is Juon and The Ring are kind of tied, but I think Juon...
The original Japanese
The Grudge.
Yeah, that's...
I think that disturbed me the most of any horror movie I've ever seen. But yeah. I got to say that Silent Hill, maybe because of my visceral background with that video game, but that movie still kind of creeps me out immensely. But that's, again, I think it's because I invested so many hours into the video game.
Yeah. All right.
We are Buddies in Space. You are.
That's Michael Smith. You are.
And Michael Crossy. We were joined by.
Jefferson Savangsuk.
The most interesting man in the world.
Yeah.
And there's no one who could argue that after listening to this episode.
And we're going to plug. Why don't you give a plug on your CD here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the CD is Peaceful Journey, solo Native American flute music for healing and comfort. And probably the best way to find it is if you go to like my website / electronic business card, jefferson.me. So, you know, on your web browser, jefferson.me, you'll find kind of links to like where you can get the music.
Bandcamp, we'll put up a link on it.
SoundCloud, Amazon.
Actually, I don't have digital forms yet. Oh, it's a hard copy.
We'll put up links to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And a week ago, you should have voted for Jefferson's nomination.
Which I'm sure.
Yeah,
won.
I hope you did. And I hope I won.
Win right now.
Buddies in Space is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. Visit stolendress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books.
Greetings from the future.
Yeah. Well, thank you again.
Yeah,
so
thank
much.
You so much for playing.
Thanks so much for inviting me. It's been a blast. It's been great. So fun hanging out with you guys.
Oh, and now the floggings will commence. Did we not mention that part? Smike, take the flute and begin beating.
No, it's a work of art.
Okay, grab the mace.
Yeah.